It is Tuesday, September 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, North Korea condemns new United Nations sanctions. We get reaction to the new sanctions from Pyongyang's neighbors.
Mostly positive in Asia, in South Korea, Japan, and China. All are voicing support for these new sanctions.
Half the residents of Florida are without power following Hurricane Irma, and U.S. farmers struggle despite the country's soaring stock market. It's all ahead. North Korea strongly criticized Tuesday the UN Security Council's decision to impose tough new sanctions against the East Asian nation and warned the United States would experience the greatest pain for playing a leading role in the effort. North Korean Ambassador Hong Tae-song at a UN-sponsored disarmament conference in Geneva said, "My delegation condemns in the strongest terms and categorically rejects the latest illegal and unlawful UN Security Council resolution." North Korea, Han said, without elaborating, is poised to use a form of ultimate means. North Korea had warned before the latest sanctions were imposed that the U.S. would pay due price if it pushed for stronger sanctions. Well, meanwhile, reaction in Asia to the latest round of international sanctions has been positive, but many are still skeptical they will have any significant impact. The Security Council Monday unanimously adopted a tough new round of economic sanctions against North Korea in response to its September 3rd nuclear test of a possible hydrogen bomb. If fully implemented, the new sanctions would significantly reduce North Korean access to international currency and fuel needed for its banned ballistic missile and nuclear programs. I spoke with VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Patton in Seoul about the reaction there.
Positive out here. It's mostly positive in Asia, in South Korea, Japan, and China. All are voicing support for these new sanctions. There's different degrees. Japan is very supportive of the sanctions and wants and very much aligned with the U.S. policy to put them maximum pressure, which is the name of the Trump policy, U.S. President Donald Trump's policy for forcing the North Korean regime to recalculate and restrain itself and come to talks for dismantling its nuclear arsenal in exchange for a relief from sanctions and economic aid and security guarantees. So there's overall a positive response, but there is skepticism. There's a level of skepticism below the surface, both among advocates of these very strong sanctions and among critics who believe that sanctions are going too far. Both say these sanctions are not going to have any significant impact.
Why do they believe that?
The hawkish side, who believe that sanctions will ultimately, strong sanctions will force the North Korean regime to pull back from its nuclear ambitions, they believe that these sanctions have not gone far enough because it puts some limits on the import of fuel. It puts some limits on the export of textiles and the export of workers, but it doesn't declare an entire ban on these industries that would, if there was a ban, would enact crippling economic pain and perhaps cause the whole North Korean regime under Kim Jong-un to collapse. So they believe that the sanctions don't go far enough. They believe that this is another incremental step. There was discussion, I guess, in the UN in which the U.S. was asking for much stronger sanctions and pulled back at the request of North Korea's key allies in the region here, Russia and China, and pulled back to these more incremental sanctions. So here's where we are. And again, it feels like we're revisiting old ground over and over again at an accelerated rate over the last year and a half, where North Korea conducts some sort of provocation, whether a missile test or a nuclear test, and the international community gathers for a new round of sanctions, and yet nothing significantly changes. And analysts I talked to said we're still kind of in that same gray area. where the sanctions are not strong enough to really make the North Korean regime choose between survival and yielding to international pressure. So that's on the hawkish side. The side that is pro-engagement thinks that nothing that the international community and the U.S. and South Korea and Japan in particular can do will force North Korea to give up its present position. And the more the U.S. and its allies try, the more that North Korea will push back and conduct more tests, because they see the aggressive moves by their enemies as more justification of why they have to maintain this nuclear arsenal.
Well, South Korean President Moon Jae-in originally had sought to have some sort of an engagement with North Korea, some sort of negotiations. But I guess the recent North Korean actions made him change that view.
The South Korean government has been humbled by what's been happening in this situation. They've been humbled by North Korea's relentless provocation in the face of the government in Seoul reaching out its hand, proposing unconditional talks, proposing new avenues for cooperation, show the world that the North Korean regime under Kim Jong-un is not irrational and aggressive and totally focused on provocations and developing nuclear weapons. So they've offered humanitarian aid. They've offered these family reunions for families that have been separated since the end of the Korean War. And North Korea has totally ignored all of South Korea's outreach.
That's VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Patton reporting from Seoul. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, a big story today out of California. Apple, the tech behemoth, iPhone, iPad,
yeah.
iMac, anything you can imagine that's technology, set to announce today the newest version of the iPhone, rumored to be either the iPhone X or the iPhone 8. Of course, this year marks 10 years since the launch of the iPhone, so that would be where the X comes from. Lots of rumors circulating on social media about the cost, some saying it could cost upwards of $1,000, new pictures of the screen, all this kind of stuff flowing around on social media ahead of that big announcement. And then, of course, the announcement itself covered extensively on social and digital media. The hashtags, the hashtag Apple event that people are using, it's going to be streamed live across all digital platforms. So people the world over are going to be watching this, very eagerly awaiting what new phone they can get as the Christmas season, the holiday season approaches. They might be doing some shopping at the Apple store. We'll
good
see.
Timing.
Yes, always good timing. They do it right in September, right before the holiday shopping begins. So good timing on their part. And a bit of an embarrassing story for Texas Senator Ted Cruz, former presidential candidate in the 2016 presidential election. His Twitter account liked a tweet that showed a video of, how can we say this, two people involved in some physical activity that's perhaps best reserved for the bedroom, not for social media.
Okay.
Social media had a bit of a field day with this, as Cruz is known as a social conservative, so not the thing that you would expect to see in his Twitter feed. Cruz telling reporters that there are numerous people who have access to the Twitter account. Someone inadvertently hit the like button on this tweet, and once they realized what it was, they quickly pulled it down. Some question there as to the security and how many people exactly have access to his Twitter account. No word on which staffer might have done this or what the consequences might be, but Cruz was good-humored about it, to his credit. He said, "If I had known that this would trend so quickly, then perhaps we should have posted something like this during the Indiana primary," of course, referring to his presidential run, unsuccessful presidential run for the Republican nomination in 2016.
All right. Very interesting. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The U.S. ambassador in Cambodia criticizes the country over intentionally inaccurate plot claims. A new report says U.S. family incomes are up, poverty is down, and more Americans are getting health insurance. Kenya's parliament opens with a boycott by the country's opposition, and Iraqi lawmakers reject a pending Kurdish independence vote. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. The sun has been quite active recently, erupting with more than a half dozen solar flares in recent days. A solar flare is described as a quick outburst of magnetic energy that occurs on or near the sun's surface. Most of the recent solar flares have been considered to be mid-level in strength, but a couple of significant flares lasted from the sun on September 6th and the 10th. Scientists from the UK's University of Sheffield and Queen's University Belfast in Northern Ireland say the September 6th eruption was the largest solar flare that's been observed in 12 years. And NASA says its Solar Dynamics Observatory detected what it describes as a significant solar flare on September 10th. Scientists say the two huge solar flares were not harmful to humans because of Earth's protective atmosphere and the distance from the sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear about the struggles of U.S. farmers. Some Florida residents started returning to their homes Tuesday in the aftermath of the widespread destruction spawned by Hurricane Irma. But officials warned the recovery would be frustrating and lengthy. Federal Emergency Management Chief Brock Long said it would take a long time for the state to recover, particularly in the Florida Keys, the string of islands at the state's southern tip. Long said a quarter of the homes there were destroyed and 65% sustained major damage. Florida Governor Rick Scott said Tuesday officials are continuing to check the 42 bridges that link the Florida Keys together.
I've been talking to the people down there. We're still having in the Keys issues with getting the water started back up, sewage, and their power back up. We've been sending the Department of Transportation down the Keys to inspect all the bridges because even though you can see that people are traveling, you're not sure that on the bridges they can take any significant weight.
Scott said facilities for the elderly have been affected by the loss of electricity in the state.
I've gotten a lot of phone calls from nursing homes and assisted living that they're having issues with their generators. And so we're doing everything we can to help them get either generators, fuel, power back on. But it's one of the issues we're dealing with aggressively to help them. We're trying to get a hold of them constantly, and a lot of them are calling me, so we're working hard with that.
Irma made landfall on the Keys Sunday. Its fierce winds, heavy rains, and storm surge left much of the low-lying islands, a top tourist magnet, underwater. David Goodhue is editor of the Upper Keys Reporter newspaper. Speaking from Miami, he was asked by International Edition's Victor Beatty if he expected the vital tourist industry to be hurt this year.
It's still a few months before our official tourist season kicks in, so depending on how bad the damage is, which I believe it is pretty extensive, it's going to have a big impact on this year's season.
Was it as bad as you thought it would be?
A few days ago, the forecast had it coming right here, so we thought it was going to be very bad. And then it started moving west more, so we pretty much dodged the bullet for the direct hit. But the feeder bands, the outer bands, are stronger than I thought they would be and lasting longer than I thought they would.
For those who don't know the Keys, could you explain exactly? These are a string of islands south of the mainland of Florida.
Yeah, it goes from Key Largo down to Key West. Yeah, it's 30-some islands, more than that, that are uninhabited, but about 30 islands with homes, businesses, strung together by the overseas highway, which is part of U.S. 1.
What would be the structural damage, the infrastructure damage to a bridge like that?
They're going to have to assess their soundness before they let people down, but I don't believe there is extensive bridge damage. Right now, there's a lot of flooding. The flooding will subside. It's storm surge. It's not necessarily like it. Well, it's not the kind of rain flooding we're seeing. You saw in Houston, this is the ocean, the bay, and the Gulf of Mexico rising because of the storm, but that will go down.
David, this is a rather notorious anniversary. It was 57 years ago that Hurricane Donna hit the Keys back in 1960.
Almost hit in the same area, the lower Keys island of Cudjoe Key, which is 23 miles east of Key West.
How long would you expect it to take for the Keys to get back, and how long will it be before people can start flowing back?
It might be at least a week before they allow people to come back in. They first have to assess the soundness of the bridges and the highway. Even before they could let utility workers back in to fix the lines, they have to basically clear it so medical personnel could go down there and treat any utility workers that, for some reason, get injured on the job. So it's going to be a long time. And then they'll talk about letting people back into their homes.
Well, after an event like Irma, do people rethink whether to leave the Florida Keys? Probably not, said David Goodhue. With hurricanes, he said, you have probably a week's worth of advance warning to lock up your house or business and seek safety, unlike areas prone to sudden disasters like tornadoes or earthquakes. Pakistan's prime minister has offered Afghanistan new methods of bilateral verification against militant sanctuaries. The country is trying to shake off the reputation it harbors militants that attack Afghanistan. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has more.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Shahid Khaqan Abbasi said his country is willing to do whatever it takes to convince the world of its resolve against terrorism. He offered, for the first time, joint verification mechanisms to Afghanistan.
We are open to bilateral verification. We are open to joint patrols. We are open to joint posts. We will put up a fence there. The Afghans are most welcome to put up another fence on their side and control that border.
This is not the first time Pakistan has tried to dispel accusations it has terrorist sanctuaries. The country has tried hard, but failed, for the past several years to convince the world it is taking action against all violent extremists on its soil. The Prime Minister said details of the bilateral verification methods could be worked out at the operational level. In turn, he demanded Afghanistan needs to do more to fight terrorism against Pakistan.
If you want statistics, there's much more happening across the border from Afghanistan into Pakistan than anything that happens from Pakistan into Afghanistan.
Pakistan has launched several military operations to clear out militant hideouts from the northern tribal areas near Afghanistan's border. But the United States and Afghanistan claim the actions have been more focused on the Pakistani Taliban, militants that have challenged the Pakistani state. They charge that the groups focused on attacking Afghanistan or India have been largely left alone. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. While U.S. stock indices continue to see record-breaking gains and U.S. employment numbers are encouraging, American farmers continue to struggle with high costs for fertilizer and seed at a time when demand and prices for their products are low. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, the economic hardship has a ripple effect beyond the farmers' fields.
The annual Farm Progress Show, this year in Decatur, Illinois, is one of the largest farming exhibitions in the world. It's where manufacturers and suppliers show off their latest products and equipment. It's a starting point for farmers researching what big-ticket items are available to make their work in the fields more efficient and easier. But all farmer Jeff Fisher can do at the John Deere exhibit is look.
$250,000 list price for this planter, and this is just a medium-sized planter. I'm interested in a planter a notch below this planter. The commodity prices aren't high enough to be able to afford it.
It's been over 5 years since Fisher's been able to afford new equipment. That was the last time he made a profit.
We're losing money. Our cost of production is higher than the price of corn on the Chicago Board of Trade and our local price.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture reports median net farm income in 2016 was the lowest since 2009, but projects a modest increase overall for 2017. But the year-over-year hardship for many U.S. farmers has affected more than just the agricultural industry.
The Equipment Manufacturers Association released some pretty dismal numbers for farm equipment sales and what that means to the Caterpillar and Deere. That's troublesome.
Tamara Nelson is the Senior Director of Commodities for the Illinois Farm Bureau. She says a decline in equipment sales affects manufacturing jobs that depend on farmers like Fisher buying new equipment.
If a farmer cannot afford to buy this, then those 25 workers that work to make it, and the steel workers who produce the steel, and all of the people involved in the parts, they are not going to have jobs either. And so farmers need to have good markets, just as manufacturers need to have good markets.
Mark Bremer grows corn and soybeans on his southern Illinois farm and also raises livestock. Like Fisher, he's also getting by using old equipment to make ends meet.
We would love to update. We'd love to purchase new technology and stuff, but that technology comes with a price. They didn't develop it free.
Bremer isn't sure when he'll be able to afford new equipment and is worried about the crop yield this year due to lack of rainfall.
We're not guaranteed the rain. We're not guaranteed the price. We're not guaranteed the yield either. So it's just a continual challenge of making it.
There's also no guarantee next year will be better. But farmer Jeff Fisher still has hope.
We're in the bottom of that roller coaster ride, it feels like right now. I hope it doesn't get worse.
But his roller coaster ride continues in just a few weeks as the next and perhaps most important phase of his work as a farmer begins, harvesting this year's corn and soybeans. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Decatur, Illinois.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The people of South Sudan are experiencing the world's worst food security crisis, one caused not by drought or flood, but by man-made conflict, a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar that spiraled into a civil war in late 2013. Famine was declared in part of South Sudan in early 2017, but with quick action on the part of the international community, including the United States, famine was alleviated 4 months later. However, the overall food security situation in South Sudan remains dire, with more than half the current population, 6 million people, facing life-threatening hunger this year. The United States is the biggest donor to the massive humanitarian effort in South Sudan. Since 2013, we have contributed nearly $2.7 billion in humanitarian assistance for the South Sudanese people, including those who have fled to neighboring countries. $729 million has been provided in 2017 alone. In South Sudan, one of the biggest obstacles to delivering emergency aid is gaining access to those in need in one of the most difficult and expensive countries in which to deliver assistance. South Sudan is also the most dangerous country in the world for aid workers. Since the conflict began in December 2013, 85 aid workers have been killed. According to the United Nations, nearly 630 incidents hindering humanitarian access occurred between January and July of this year. Some 36% of them involved violence against humanitarian personnel, assets, or civilian infrastructure. So far this year, 27 security incidents have forced around 300 relief workers to relocate from areas of operation. At the same time, humanitarian aid organizations have complained that their movements are often restricted, often by the government. During a visit to South Sudan on September 2nd, USAID Administrator Mark Green said, "While it is true that we support the people of South Sudan, it is just as true that the situation has deteriorated to the point where a serious reexamination of U.S. policy is appropriate. We urge President Kiir and his government to both acknowledge and address the worsening humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, restore a permanent ceasefire by ceasing ongoing military offensives,
end obstruction of humanitarian access, eliminate exorbitant fees levied on aid organizations, and engage in a meaningful, inclusive peace process.